Good afternoon. I would like to call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. I think a quorum is now present, and so we would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
We'll move.
Representative Moran moves to approve the minutes of February 19th. Don't all everybody fight over them. It's okay. And is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved.
We're listening.
Okay. So, members, we are now moving into a different phase of the session. As experienced members know, we now have the governor's budget recommendations. And those are recommendations. They obviously, the bills have to be passed by the House and Senate, not by the governor. But it is very helpful often to have a governor's budget to work off of. And we are pleased today to welcome Commissioner Jan Malcolm from the Department of Health to discuss with us the governor's budget recommendations as related to the Department of Health. So, welcome to the committee, Commissioner Malcolm. And what we have discussed doing and kind of the procedure we've done before, members, is to let the commissioner go through sections of her presentation. We'll hold questions until the end of a section. So please jot down your questions as they occur to you. However, if you have a question, something like what's that acronym or what is that chart saying, something that you just need clarification in order to understand what's being presented, please do raise your hand for that. Otherwise, we'll try to let her get through her presentation before we ask at least pieces of her presentation before we have members asking questions. So with that, Commissioner, welcome, and please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for this opportunity to present the governor's recommendations for the Minnesota Department of Health to you. I'm just extremely grateful that the governor's budget really does support the range of public health activities that you were generous enough to give me some time to describe kind of what we do at the Department of Health. And what you'll see in these budget proposals really does kind of reflect the breadth and the scope of public health activities. So we've got a really quite a wide array of topics to discuss in the next hour and a half. So I appreciate the chair's suggestion that kind of go section by section. Here with me at the table is Deputy Commissioner of the Health Department, Margaret Kelly. She will be assisting me with budget-related questions. Two of my assistant commissioners are also here if we get into substantive questions in their areas, and I'll introduce them at that time. So I think we'll just dive in, and I will try to be brief in my comments. You, of course, have all the detail in the budget books before you, but I'll just try to underscore what is particularly significant in these proposals.
And if I could just for one moment, Commissioner, and just so members know, first of all, we have a copy of the presentation in your packets. But, Commissioner, what we have before us is actually the budget book from the current budget. We don't yet have the change pages in front of us.
Oh, we do.
Oh, my gosh. I'm amazed. This Ian Hopper is even more efficient than I realized. Okay, good. Well, I'm glad we got that clarified because I thought this was the old book, not the new one. So, oh, my goodness. Okay.
Staff are wonderful, aren't they? Thank you so much. Okay, so as we just heard yesterday from the governor and lieutenant governor, the governor's overarching priorities in his first budget are in the realms of education, health care, and community prosperity. And for us in public health, we really see our role as supporting all three of those budget priority areas. We know the importance of health to educational success and to community prosperity, as well as you have heard me say many times now, the importance of working more intentionally upstream to help bend the cost curve for Minnesotans long-term, and even more importantly, to improve the health status of all of our neighbors. So these public health approaches that we're going to talk about aren't just really in the health the healthcare bucket, but really speak to the governor's priorities for community prosperity and even education. The next slide is, this would be slide three in your packet, is a very busy slide, but it's all in one place, all of the recommendations by fund type. And we're going to go through each of these proposals, but just at a high level, what you see here, and all of the numbers that I'm sharing with you today are totals for the first biennium. So in your budget books, you see this the breakdown by year and the out biennium as well. But here today, we're just talking about total first biennium. So this page just shows you that of the just under $49 million in general fund requests, about half of that, just under half, is for the two packages related to vulnerable adult protection. Just under half of the total general fund requests are prevention investments in suicide, tobacco cessation, community solutions fund, and family planning. And the remainder, about 10% of the general fund ask, is for other operating needs. There's a little under $13 million in recommendations from the state government special revenue fund. These are fee-based programs, as you well know. And about a half of the increased appropriation requests in this category are to access fee revenue that's already been collected. So it's already money in the accounts. This does not represent fee increase proposals in the main, but rather an appropriation to the department of fees that have already been paid by the folks who benefit from these programs. $1 million in requests from the Healthcare Access Fund for some of our important analytic work and the share of kind of agency overhead or operating costs that are borne by the Access Fund. And just under $29 million from other funds, $15 million from the proposed new Opioid Stewardship Fund, and $14 million from Clean Water Funds. So that's just a very high-level overview. Now going into the proposals themselves, I'd like to talk about the two packages related to vulnerable adults first, and then we can pause for your questions there. So as I think we talked a little bit about in Chair Moran's committee just yesterday, we've got two proposals here, two packages essentially. The first, which we call current program improvements, are to continue the improvement efforts that began in earnest in 2017 and 18, really informed by what we've accomplished so far and what we've learned in the process of fixing some of the underlying systems in our Office of Health Facility Complaints. We've really taken some of those improvement lessons to heart and are now applying them across other regulatory areas that have to do with protecting all Minnesotans, so not just the complaint receipt end, but some of the broader licensing and certification and inspection functions as well. So in this proposal, which is just under $13 million in general fund request and an additional a little over $2 million in fee-based revenues, you see on the slide there kind of the major themes. This is to improve our current operations under current state law, increasing our regulatory capacity, which includes a very important need for the state match, which is required by the feds, as the volume of regulatory work in federally certified facilities grows as a result of the aging of the population and the growth in the industry. The state is required to, as it is in many of the DHS programs, to match what the feds fund in that area. So a large part of this request is for the required state match. Another part of the regulatory capacity proposal here is to add additional surveyors in the home care inspection area, which is necessary to keep pace with growth in that industry and where we have also been behind. Applying continuous improvement learnings that we've had leads us to make this request as well. And this fee-based proposal to add to home care survey capacity is a one-time request. Because of the reform proposal that we'll talk about in a minute, we imagine that that new construct for how we regulate assisted living providers and home care providers will change kind of the composition and the scope of that work. So this is a one-time proposal. So regulatory capacity is what is the main goal of these current program improvements. But additionally, to make the whole operation more effective and efficient, we, as the legislative auditor called for last year, badly need to replace what is an underbuilt, incomplete, and now badly outmoded case management system at the department, which has required us to do a lot of paper processes to work around the gaps in this old legacy system, which really needs to be replaced. So we have a multi-year kind of modular proposal to be as cost-effective as we can to connect to the Department of Human Services Social Services Information System, or SSIS, for kind of the backbone of the case management system, which is not only cost-effective, but we think brings other benefits as well in terms of being able to connect the activities across the two agencies. We'll also integrate some other health department information systems that we are putting in place for electronic licensing across many different types of providers, and the electronic document management system, which we created and installed in 2018 to help us with the paper management on the complaint end. This will also incorporate a common entry point with the MARC system, the Minnesota Adult Abuse and Reporting Center, and it will also align with new public reporting website capability where consumers can search and sort and look for information about providers to help inform their choices, and similarly for providers to be able to access information for their own learning and improvement purposes. The third component here is for improved data analysis and reporting. I just feel passionately and, again, appreciate the legislative auditor pointing this out so clearly last year, that what a lost opportunity it is for us not to take better advantage of all the information that flows through this system for purposes of trend analysis and working further upstream with researchers and providers and stakeholders to try to prevent problems to begin with. And the final component of this package is to strengthen our communications and engagement with various stakeholders by just improving the quality of the information that we are posting online and other materials for key audiences to interact with the program. So that is the current operations proposal. The second companion piece is the regulatory reform proposal, which, again, was called for strongly by the legislative auditor last year, and both bodies spent significant time learning about and debating proposals to fill in some of the gaps in the Minnesota's regulatory system for long-term care, specifically the fact that we had become an outlier state by not licensing assisted living facilities, which, as you heard from Representative Olson yesterday and Representative Schultz, is now the largest part of the industry in terms of where people are actually receiving their care. So we're talking about over 40,000 people living in 1,345 current assisted living settings in Minnesota, where the care given to those folks ranges from quite basic and quite simple to really quite complex, and can even include and does include care for many persons with cognitive impairments. In fact, we know that almost 60% of the people living in these assisted living settings are over the age of 85, and almost 40% of them have diagnoses of dementia. So that's a very significant thing. And we know that these numbers are only going to increase, and the complexity of care needs is only going to increase as the population continues to age and as healthcare continues to advance to keep people living longer with more and more complex conditions. So I think what we've all come to realize over the last couple of years is just the degree to which, as the population has aged, as care needs have evolved, assisted living settings are providing care probably pretty far beyond what might have been originally envisioned when the concept of housing with services was first invented quite some time ago now. So the current laws that we have in place for the housing with services, which is what assisted livings are today, regarded as housing with services, which requires only registration, not licensure, the current laws with respect to housing with services don't have any standards for the physical plant of the building, nor for the supportive services provided in the facility, nor for the people employed by the housing with services entity. Existing consumer protection laws are confusing for residents and families and make it difficult for them to know, much less enforce their rights. This proposal addresses the regulatory gaps in these laws by creating a new assisted living license that regulates both the home care services and the housing together in one license and sets standards for a new dementia care license and authorizes the department to collect immediate fines when we find violations rather than the current approach, which allows the provider time to cure the violations before the fine is applied. And another key feature of this is the prohibition of deceptive marketing practices. So as I mentioned quite briefly yesterday in Chair Moran's committee, this the administration's proposal for regulatory reform, I think, has a lot of components in common with what Representative Olson presented yesterday and what the provider organizations and the long-term care imperative have also been working on. We're going to be working over the next several days, now that we have language available, to get stakeholders' reaction and input to that language before we bring it back to you for committee review. But I think the three-tiered license approach that I mentioned yesterday, just to remind you, there would be three levels of licensure within assisted living: a basic assisted living license, a comprehensive assisted living license for a more comprehensive set of health services, and then what we've termed a comprehensive plus license, which would be for facilities offering dementia care services as well. We propose in our language, and this budget contemplates a four-year implementation period for this new licensure system. The first year, July of 2019 to June of 2020, would be the year in which we would do expedited rulemaking. There's just a lot of important detail to be developed through rulemaking, such as the specific standards for staffing, for training. There's just a lot more detail to be worked out in the rulemaking process, which even an expedited rule takes at minimum a year to do. So this would be to finalize the standards for physical plants, staffing and training, healthcare practices, and enhanced consumer protections. And during this first year, then, while we're doing the rulemaking, we would be gearing up at the health department to implement the new system. In the second year, so July 1st of 2020 to June 30th of 2021, is really a transition period. This is a pretty significant change for the industry, and we believe it makes sense to give some time for current providers to come into compliance with the new laws so that as we start to license and hold providers to a higher standard, that they've had some time to prepare for that. This would also be a time period in which the department would be hiring and training and building the infrastructure to do this very significant new program. As of July of 2021, any new provider entering the assisted living field would need to be licensed under the new laws. That would also apply to changes of ownership. So if ownership is going to change, that will trigger the requirement for a new license, and so change of ownership would be treated as a new provider and held to the new licensing standards in July of 21. The third year then, July of 21 to 22, all the existing current home care licensees would be required to convert over. Those who wish to function as assisted living providers would convert over to the new licensure system, such that the fourth year then, beginning in July of 2022, would be the first full year of licensure, so fully in effect for all providers by July of 22. I mentioned one important improvement, we believe, is authorizing the department to immediately impose fines against providers when violations are detected during either inspections or complaint investigations, instead of having to wait for the opportunity to correct the violation before imposing a fine. We think that serves as an appropriate incentive for providers to take these requirements seriously and to work proactively to prevent them. And again, prohibiting deceptive marketing and false advertising practices is a very key part of enhancing consumer, the clarity of consumers' choices, the reality of those choices, and to make sure that providers can deliver what they are marketing. I just would mention that these two proposals from the Health Department are paired very closely, as you heard from Assistant Commissioner Pollack at DHS yesterday. These things go hand in glove with some of the proposals from DHS to increase capacity for the Ombudsman, to increase collaboration and coordination with civil and law enforcement processes. And also, there's a proposal from the Commerce Department to expand the senior fraud prevention initiative over there. So we've approached this as a cross-agency collaborative that aims to use all of the tools all of us have in a more coordinated way to be moving forward on this issue. So if we could just talk about those two packages together. There's multiple line items in each one, but hopefully they make sense to you as a package.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Loeffler has the question, and then Schumacher.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, my first comment was about your regulatory reforms. One of the hardest things about serving in Health and Human Services, and I always have some real empathy for the freshmen, is we have more acronyms and more language and more terms than I think any other committee here. And they're constantly shifting, and so we need to avoid unnecessarily doing that. And case management is a term we use a lot in the human services side, and it's about coordinating care to an individual. It's about the care that they get from any variety of providers, including family, and it's about services to an individual. And so when you said that you were going to create this new case management program, I thought, whoa, the health department's getting involved in case management and care plans for individuals and care conferences. And I realized, based on your description, you're talking about a IT response management system where you get a complaint, you have an obligation to log it in, to check on all kinds of different bases the information that's there, and follow and track that complaint until it gets resolved. And I would just really encourage you to think of a different name, because we'll all communicate better if we do that. But I think it's important to keep track of that. My second comment would be on the I understand why licensing can't instantaneously happen, and I think you've outlined a thoughtful process going forward. What I didn't hear, and what I hope that we'll continue to pursue, is how do we immediately start to reduce the number of complaints that are coming in, and create a culture of care and respect within the industry, while at the same time we're, you know, improving our regulatory oversight. Because, you know, to have over 20,000 complaints coming in a year is, you know, outrageous. And we know some of them are minor things, but some of them are pretty major that we've heard about. And so I'd like to hear what you see happening while you're doing the work to get the licensing structure set up.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, great points, and thanks for the suggestion on the language on case management. You're absolutely right. I think there's every intent to continue improving not only our regulatory operations, but our use of information to be more proactive, to work with the Ombudsman, to work with families, to work with providers on strategies to resolve concerns earlier in the process. I think the Ombudsman resource is a tremendous one that can be very, very valuable to people to help them resolve issues before they get to the point of a breakdown in communications and in care. So I think that is an important aspect. And doing the work that we're doing now to try to make data more available for ourselves, for analytic purposes and for the industry as well, to understand what, digging into all this data that we've really never looked at in that way, partly because we haven't had the automated systems that enable us to sort and pull things in a rapid way, really does allow us to say, gee, let's look at what are some of the types of reports that are coming in that are in common or that are particularly on the rise, and what might we do of a proactive nature to try to decrease the number of those complaints. So it's an excellent point, and I certainly do think that not only can some of the consumer protections be put in place more quickly than licensure, but some of these analytic and prevention strategies as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. So we have Schumacher, Baker, and Haley, and then I think after we take those three, if we can, we'd like to move on, because we do want to give the commissioner an opportunity to get through the presentation. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have two questions. I'll just ask them both at the same time. First, I was wondering when we'll be able to see the language for this piece, and then the second is on the licensing fees here, just what the cost of the license is going to be. You're at the basic or the comprehensive plus, what a center might be looking at for what those licenses are going to cost. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, thanks. I'm looking to my colleague here to answer the fee question, if we have it in the change page. I'm not sure we do. Another colleague who's here, Assistant Commissioner Dotson. Marie, if you know that answer, you can come on up. First, I'll answer your question about the language. So we are literally just this morning shared the language with stakeholders to try to get some feedback for them before we give the language to Chair Schultz and Representative Olson, as well as folks on the Senate side. So we're just going to want to do another round over the next literally few days to try to be able to give you language that's in the best possible shape. As I've mentioned several times, we do have, I think, genuine consensus at the level of key components and ideas, but that's different from having agreement on language. So we're working at that level now. Representative Schultz has asked, for that language as early next week as we possibly can do it. So that's what our goal is. With respect to the fine levels, the licensure fees was your question, right?
Right. Deputy Calvert.
Madam Chair, Representative, the numbers are not in our change page. They will be in our real language, but the basic licensure for the initial application is $5,500, comprehensive is $9,500, and the comprehensive plus is $14,500. That's just for the initial application.
Representative Schumacher. Okay, thank you. Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Commissioner, as a business owner myself I would say, a very good working relationship with your department, with my restaurant. We have inspections with our both county health and state health. I'm concerned about your point about imposing immediate fines for violations. You know, I make mistakes in my business, and once in a while when we do, my inspector and I work together, make sure we correct it quickly if it's a major issue or a minor issue. That wording frightens me a bit, that now the state is becoming not a partner and a collaborator, but a more of a fine master. And I think I just made mine is more of a statement to say, as we develop this licensing program, which is important, I hope that the aggressiveness of this or the wording of these kind of things is still not deflecting what needs to be done, which is getting us on board, if I was in that system, which I'm not, but getting us all to make sure that we're doing a better job. Completely agree with the deceptive marketing. We got to hammer on those things real quick. But I want to make sure that they're not guilty before they have a chance to be innocent. I want to make sure that we never forget that, because business owners and companies like this want to do good. I think, as we've heard before, a vast majority of them do good. And we don't want to make mistakes, but when we do, don't slap us with public humiliation or shaming when we've got to learn some of these new rules too. So it was really more of a comment than anything, Commissioner, because that frightens me when I see any agency looking at that is a aggressive line, and I just want to be careful of that. So that would be my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. It's nice to make eye contact. I have two questions. And first of all, in the new system, you mentioned obviously staff and hiring. Does the budget include the staffing? And can you tell me how many staff you think it's going to take to implement the new program? I'll ask Deputy Kelly to answer that one.
All right, Deputy Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, the budget request does reflect the cost of hiring the staff. You can see that on the table on page 19 of the document.
Deputy Kelly, could you pull your mic closer?
Sure, I'm sorry. The initial 8.5 staff in the very first year to do the rulemaking and to do other work, we would begin hiring staff to implement the licensing work, 53 staff in fiscal year 21, and fully staffed in fiscal year 22 with 94 additional FTEs.
Thank you.
Representative Haley.
And then I have a question regarding the case management system or whatever you might call it. Is this going to be something we have to build from scratch? Is it a minute IT program? Are you looking at external sources who do this kind of work? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did a request for information earlier in 2018 to try to get a feel for what was out in the market, and that's part of what made us kind of come back to a more modular approach of trying to not build a one single system de novo, but to be able to connect to existing systems like the system that DHS uses, the SSIS system, will be helpful for a lot, but not all of our needs. So that's not a new system. It would require a little bit of IT work to create the ability for MDH to have access to the DHS system. Some of the other components of the system, like the electronic licensing system that is being put in place across MDH so that we can more expeditiously license the full variety of folks that we license, from folks in the environmental health arena to healthcare providers. So those are kind of existing functions that there will be some IT work to make them talk to each other, but we're not looking to build a whole brand new system.
Okay, thank you. I guess I would just encourage that we look at what's out in the marketplace, as we have so many IT needs across the entire state, and most recently don't have a very good track record with those systems. Particularly, I've worked in the hospital setting, and we manage a lot of adverse events, and the hospital system all over the country, but Minnesota's done a phenomenal job of kind of improving our way of doing that, and I see a lot of correlations to what you're trying to do when you have so many various inputs and you need a quick response to a patient and to a consumer. Let's look to industries that are doing that well, and maybe we don't have to recreate so much. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Haley. We're going to move on. And members, let me just kind of remind you, I know that it's really, I'm really interested to hear what the administration has come up with, and it's pretty exciting. But this is not the only time we'll hear these things. This is really an overview, and it's a well-detailed overview, which I appreciate. But we will have an opportunity when we will hear bills related to these things as well, and that will be another opportunity to get into the nitty-gritty and perhaps even debate some of the issues and even amend some of the bills. So, you know, just please keep that in mind. So, Commissioner, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next budget proposal is for some important improvements in replacements to our public health laboratory equipment. You've heard me described before the fact that our public health lab in Minnesota is really a gem and really something for the state to be proud of. It's one of the leading public health labs in the nation. Really reflects the benefit of state investment in public health that has helped us to leverage a lot of federal not only funding but the chance to be in the front of the line when new
technologies, new scientific approaches to detection of a variety of things happens. So we're often one of the first to be applying new methods in the nation. So this is a one-time general fund request of $1.5 million, which would allow us in a quite a targeted way to purchase some capital equipment that is in particular need of replacement. We've got some equipment that's no longer supported by the vendor, and it really undermines our the security of our information technology infrastructure. All of this equipment produces very valuable data that needs to be rigorously safeguarded, of course. This would also allow the purchase of some specific additional equipment to support faster and more accurate detection of certain health threats. And it also would allow us to replace parts of the water and air purification systems in the lab to maintain a stable environment for laboratory testing. We discovered a number of years ago when we had the prior polar vortex that some of the air exchange systems were not quite as robust as they needed to be, and so we discovered a need to make some improvements in the water and air systems in the lab. So that is a kind of a very specific request, a little bit unlike the others in that it is a one-time and for equipment. So if there aren't any questions on that one, the next, I'd like to talk about the opioid abuse and opioid and other drug abuse prevention and suicide prevention, perhaps as a package. They're both extremely important topics, but they do share a couple of characteristics that might lend themselves to questions from the committee. So first on the opioid and other drug abuse prevention package, again, this is part of an interagency, cross-agency set of proposals that I'll mention the other agency's work in a second. But the MDH, this budget, contains a $15.2 million biennial funding from the governor's proposed new stewardship fund, which is made up of a number of different funding streams related to registration fees on manufacturers and distributors and others in the supply chain. The MDH components of this are so important because, as you know, we've just seen a catastrophic rate of increase in opioid-related deaths, a 640% increase since the year 2000. Last year, 422 Minnesotans died from an opioid overdose, and we know that there are huge disparities also with some communities being much more adversely affected by this crisis than others. And the death statistics, while those are chilling, are obviously indicative of a far bigger problem when it comes to the amount of illness and disability and disruption in families and communities that this causes. For every death, there are 2 inpatient hospital admissions, 4 ER visits, 7 EMS runs, and 30 related treatment admissions. So just thinking about sort of what else is going on in addition to these death statistics, and it starts to really show you the breadth of this public health challenge in Minnesota. From a health equity perspective, we know that African Americans have 2.5 times the death rate from opioid-related substance abuse than the white population, which is the 5th largest disparity in the nation. The American Indian population has fully 6 times the death rate of the white population, the worst, the highest death rate for American Indians in the nation, and the greatest disparity between the American Indian population and whites. So this is, as the governor described it yesterday, I think both a moral and an economic crisis in our state. So this prevention package would do several things. First, it would expand access to naloxone so that all first responders have at least two doses of naloxone with them. We know what a difference a lifesaver that can be when administered timely by first responders and troopers. The second component are culturally specific grants. I just spoke about the importance of really targeting these efforts where communities are being particularly devastated. And funding will allow tribal nations and community organizations to implement components of a project known as the Menominee Project from the Menominee Tribe in Wisconsin that has proven some very impressive results in that population, which has demonstrably reduced overdose deaths and also hospitalizations. A third element of this package are opioid pilot projects at the community level. We began doing this work in 2017 with a really promising kind of best practice model out of the St. Gabriel's Health System in Little Falls, which has now been replicated in a number of communities. This funding would allow us to continue and expand those pilot projects and add, I think, 8 new communities per year, if I'm remembering, so that the funding would be for 2 years, a first year kind of planning grant, a second year implementation grant. And so each year, one group of communities would kind of graduate, if you will, having had 2 years to build a sustainable program locally, and another 8 communities would be added into the project. So some really impressive results coming out of these community-based pilots with respect to not only reductions in hospitalizations and death from opioids, but also upstream, very significantly reducing the opioid prescription rate to begin with. So that both of those, the culturally specific grants to Native nations and community organizations, and these local communities are strongly based in models that have proven some success. The fourth component here is something called a community fatality review team, which is has shown some really interesting results in other states. We've not used community fatality reviews yet in Minnesota, but we're eager to apply the lessons learned from other states. What this is to, you put together a multidisciplinary group of folks to take a look at overdose deaths in a community over a period of time, to really be looking across those perspectives: healthcare, education, nonprofits, law enforcement, community-serving organizations, to look at the deaths and the kind of the system circumstances that might have contributed to them. Where were the gaps in access, in service, and it's just kind of amazing how the community level of knowledge of kind of what's going on to create the context around these statistics really leads to better identification of at-risk populations and the identification of particular intervention points that might be amenable to that local community's solutions. So that is an interesting strategy that we're eager to try here. The next slide just mentions the other elements of the governor's opioid abuse prevention strategy, with elements at the Board of Pharmacy around continuing the controlled substance monitoring program. Board of Pharmacy would be the holder of the proposed fees that create the stewardship fund, medication-assisted treatment in the correction setting, drug investigations and public safety, access to additional grants for tribes and counties in the child maltreatment system and with Native Nations through DHS, an opioid advisory council, and a grant evaluation component. So I just really appreciate the fact that the governor's taking a very systemic and comprehensive and holistic approach to this, both on the treatment side and the prevention side and the intervention side in terms of working with community partners. I would also like to talk about the next proposal, comprehensive suicide prevention. Again, a very distinct.
Commissioner, before you, certainly. We are hearing
some feedback or echoes on the mics, and we have somebody here to take a look at that. So what I would ask you to do is think that Deputy Kelly's mic, well, mine's doing the same thing. I think Deputy Kelly's mic was better. If we could just have you perhaps, we'll just give him a moment, see if he can get it straightened out.
Want to say something?
Okay, that's better.
Try that.
Yeah, can you hear me on the mic?
Am I still projecting? Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
Hey,
thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I was hearing that, too.
Yes, please continue.
Thank you. So I'm just going to talk about the suicide package as well, and then we can pause for questions there. And these are some of the more complicated proposals on the front end here. I know Margaret's helping me watch the time, but these are where I think potentially a lot of your questions would be in these first few. The comprehensive suicide prevention package is similar in some respects in that it, again, takes a comprehensive approach and a strongly prevention-oriented approach. In 2017, we had 783 deaths by suicide in Minnesota, almost an 80% increase since the year 2000. And here again, it's a similar story of communities being disproportionately impacted by suicide deaths. We've been doing a lot of good work over the last few years in suicide prevention. This really is an attempt to invest more in some of the components that are already working. This is a $7.8 million general fund biennial ask. This, too, would expand an existing effective grant program to reach more communities. We currently have 6 grantees working in a community-based prevention program. This would expand it to 21 communities. And focusing those grants on communities experiencing the greatest disparities. Second component would be to provide evidence-based training and resources to the schools. Suicide in schools is obviously a huge concern. Teachers are actually required to take suicide prevention training as part of their license renewal. This proposal would support that training and not only on the staff level but also purchasing curriculum for student use statewide. So that's an important component. Third component is related to the healthcare system, implementing something known as the zero suicide model, which is rapidly becoming sort of the best practice in care across behavioral health organizations and healthcare delivery organizations. It really focuses in on making sure everyone in the system is trained to work successfully with folks at risk of suicide, helping them get access to the right services at the right time, and particularly being attentive also to the period of time immediately after discharge from a healthcare setting is a high risk period for individuals who have been receiving treatment for suicide risk. There are currently 16 organizations that we are working with to implement this model using federal funds. So additional state funds would let us double that effort and really spread this emerging best practice to more and more healthcare and behavioral health organizations across the state. The next element of this is to fund or refund a national suicide prevention lifeline in Minnesota. We had this resource in Minnesota up until last summer when the funding stopped. What happened after we lost the Minnesota-based phone line was that we relied on surrounding states. There is a national system, so we're able to tap into other states, but the response times are not as fast and not as connected to local resources as a state-based system would be. So this is proposing to create a state-based system of lifelines with regional providers connected to regional resources that really dramatically reduces the call wait times by so doing, and we know how important time can be for folks who are reaching out for this kind of emergency help. And the last component of this proposal is similar to the opioid proposal, community-level fatality review teams to, again, put these data in the context of specific local observances and conditions to inform prioritization of of at-risk populations and prevention efforts. So I'll pause there, Madam Chair, if there are questions on those two.
I'm not seeing any, Commissioner. I just, you know, maybe when we, in the next phase, when we hear the bills, it would be great if the committee could maybe get some of the most current statistics on suicide. You know, I'm thinking, you know, ages,
yes,
populations, that would be, I think, of interest.
I'd be glad to do that, Madam Chair. We have seen some disturbing changes in the underlying trends, particularly in greater Minnesota and among youth, where our rates are rising faster than the national average.
Yeah. Oh, and there was one question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. And just real quickly, Ms. Commissioner or Madam Commissioner, about the opioids. And you had said there was going to be an increased requirement for emergency officials, or not officials.
First responders?
Yeah, first responders. So how far down does that go? Are you looking into requiring local law enforcement to carry, or local first responders, law enforcement, or you know, fire to carry as well, or is it just state?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's not actually a requirement, at least not not from us. I'm unaware of what law enforcement might set as standards or requirements, but this is to make it available so that every first responder has at least two doses of naloxone.
I see. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Another question, Representative Grunigan.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the suicide prevention in the schools, I was on a school board for quite a few years. 16, I think. I'm losing count. But one of the things that I looked into was our so-called death ed or suicide ed curriculum when I was in the public school. And there was some very disturbing information in some of that curriculum. I just happen to have an extra packet in my office. I went and got it, so I'll share it with you afterwards. But I would just encourage you to be very careful that this suicide education in the schools is actually evidence-based and not just has a lot of good-sounding themes behind it, because some of the curriculum I reviewed at the time when I was on the school board was very disturbing, not only to myself, but also some of the parents and even some of the teachers. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the comment. And it certainly is the intention that this be strongly evidence-based and well-tested. So thank you. I'd be interested to see your...
And just, Representative Grunhagen, those two things are not incompatible, you know.
But
it could be disturbing to some people and still evidence-based. Just, you know, let's just keep that in mind. So
I'll show you later.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I look forward to seeing that. Please continue, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next proposal is called the Community Solutions Fund. The Governor mentioned this in his remarks yesterday. This is directly related to community prosperity and to the pervasive and persistent health inequities that we see in Minnesota. It's not just health inequities. It's inequities in education and in wealth creation and income. So this is a proposal that $2 million in one-time general fund appropriation, that $2 million would be available to be spent over both of the upcoming biennia, is really targeted at community prosperity to really invest in and enable community-based organizations themselves to be empowered, to be setting the strategies for working in a culturally appropriate, community-specific way to enhance, in this case, very, very intentionally focused on both on early childhood development, which benefits both education and health outcomes. And it really is a reflection, I think, of the fact that we've been hearing for years from communities that they don't feel
like their voices are being heard as we attempt to work on health disparities and to respond to the known disparities, that they don't feel that their perspective or their experience is sufficiently in the mix. And this is really an attempt to be responsive to that request, to create more community engagement, which needs to be an intentional thing. It takes time, and it takes resources to invest in communities' ability to really come to the table to shape their own solutions. So that is the nature of this proposal. So that's kind of I don't put that necessarily in any particular category, so.
Okay. I haven't seen any questions on that so far. So
okay.
Please continue.
The next proposal is $4.5 million from the general fund to continue the statewide tobacco cessation quit line, currently called Quit Plan, that's been operated since for many years now by the organization Clearway Minnesota, that was funded with Minnesota with a portion of Minnesota's tobacco settlement dollars, as court ordered that it be given to this independent nonprofit, which has a limited life under the court order. So as Clearway is ramping down, we need to figure out how to continue certain of the efforts that Clearway has made that have made a big difference in Minnesota, cessation support being one of them. There are still 580,000 current adult smokers in Minnesota, many of whom are trying to quit and who find the assistance of counseling and nicotine replacement therapies to be very helpful in their attempts to quit. This still is the number one cause of preventable disease in Minnesota, even though we've been working on it for generations. The quit line really has proven its value in terms of helping improve cessation success rates, and we know what a huge health issue this is, and also a giant economic issue in Minnesota. So we think this is wise to continue to invest in this prevention resource as Clearway winds down its operations. So this has our strong support.
And Commissioner, assuming that we're able to do that, what you just described, is there any element of Clearway that is not being continued on into this new life? I mean, are we losing anything in terms of the tobacco prevention or cessation efforts?
Madam Chair, that as Clearway goes out of business over the next few years, I think it's incumbent on all of us to understand what are the activities that will cease when Clearway ceases and how might we best continue those. As I think this committee is well aware, Minnesota does continue to collect a lot of revenue related to the tobacco industry through cigarette fees and from the tobacco settlement. But at this point in time, we're not directing those in any sort of strategic way to prevention and cessation around tobacco. So I think it's a conversation I would love to dig into over the next couple of years. Because there's valuable research being done by Quitline and broad public education campaigns. They've been very active in local work looking at ordinances. They were a huge partner in updating the Clean Indoor Air Act. So I do think it's a really important part of our tobacco control infrastructure that is going to be changing over the next couple of years.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Law.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I agree that tobacco is really important, but I hope as we evolve into the new daughter of Clearway, however it evolves, that we really spend some new attention on the e-vaping and the youth use of that. We had a physician testify here when we had a hearing on the proposal to continue this on, that the majority of the teenagers he's worked with don't even understand that there's nicotine in what they're using. And, you know, we've had, I think, more people are aware of traditional cigarettes and their harm, but I have not seen the kind of public education effort, creative outreach. You know, maybe we have to go back to the target market sort of style of doing things. But somehow I think this new effort has to address the new addiction while continuing to offer opportunities for people who are addicted to traditional cigarettes. But we'll be really missing the mark if we don't start a major initiative directed at our youth and what they're using.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I completely agree. It is a whole new dimension of the tobacco challenge around electronic cigarettes. So moving on, I know our time's running short. The next proposal is for an expansion, an addition of $6 million over the biennium to the Family Planning Special Project Grant Program, which is, I think, strongly related to community prosperity as well. This would increase access to family planning services, which have been shown to be so very effective at improving birth outcomes, as well as improving the economic prospects of youths and avoiding unintended pregnancies, reducing disparities in unintended pregnancy and teen pregnancy rates continues to be a real challenge in our state, and addressing an exponentially increasing rate of sexually transmitted infections in Minnesota. So this, the Family Planning Special Grants Program has been around for a long time. It's a valuable piece of the public health infrastructure around the state, we receive many more requests for grant funding dollars than we have in the program. So this is an attempt to be able to meet more of the where are the needs that are being expressed by the grantees. So that one also is kind of a standalone. The next several are of a different nature. Questions there? Okay. The next package is related to the importance of clean drinking water in Minnesota. The first proposal is one that you have seen in prior years, renewing it again this year. The request is to increase the connection fee, the per service connection to public water systems fee during would increase the fee from its current level to up to $9.72 per year. The fee has not been raised since 2005. And so during that 14-year period, the inflation has eroded the effectiveness of our funding a lot. And I just want to reinforce that this is really quite a unique approach to protecting public drinking water that we have here in Minnesota, unlike states that rely on public water systems to do all of their own water quality monitoring and report back to the state. This, our Minnesota's Safe Drinking Water Program is much more proactive and has the state in a position to provide education and technical assistance to water suppliers all over the state, particularly useful for smaller communities who lack some of those technical resources themselves to keep systems from having a problem to begin with. And this really does is a big part of what enables us to have maintained such a high quality rating and a high level of compliance with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, is because we're in this very proactive posture of going out and monitoring and working with local water suppliers. So I believe that the fee increase has strong support from water system operators around the state and local government. So that's the fee proposal. In addition, I'm really quite enthused about the fact that we're making a big push to make drinking water a much higher visible priority for Minnesotans. And there's a companion set of actually 8 proposals that will go before the Legacy Committee funded by the Clean Water Fund. But I just wanted this committee to be aware of that in the governor's budget, and that we're making a real effort to do a better job of integrating drinking water as a priority and a concern with all the work that is going on around protecting Minnesota's waters. We simply cannot just assume that the drinking water is fine. As the science has evolved, as growth has evolved, we dare not rest on our laurels, and we know that there are particular challenges with private well owners and need to do just a much more thorough job of integrating drinking water
goals and strategies into what's going on now with the Clean Water Fund, and we're very grateful for the Clean Water Council's support of these proposals to start to do just that. So you can sort of see the drinking water fee as a, you know, a component of a much larger strategy to make sure that we're staying on top of this very, very critical public health issue for our state.
Thank you, Commissioner. I in terms of drinking water, I am really glad to see this, and it just makes me think, you know, anybody who comes from a public health background knows about John Snow and the candle on the
where pump, it all began,
where he figured out that the cholera was coming from certain pump, and you know, before people understood anything about cholera or other kinds of infectious disease, and took the handle off the pump, and that cured the cholera outbreak. So, you know, it's we don't talk a lot about the department's actions with in terms of water. That always comes into this committee as a bit of a peripheral thing, but I'm glad if there's more focus on it. And I won't ask you to stop now and explain, but maybe later on you could explain a bit more how the department interacts with the various systems around the state. I mean, at least that's not very clear to me, but I'd like to learn more about it maybe later on. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Okay, we're down to our last several proposals here. The next one is related to one of our regulatory functions in the managed care section. This is to increase our capacity to do provider network adequacy reviews. We are responsible for assuring or reviewing the network adequacy proposed by Minnesota's health plans. Both HMOs and non-HMOs need to meet the requirements for network adequacy in state and federal law. However, our ability to do that has been quite constrained as products have proliferated and more health plans are offering different varieties of network products. Our capacity to really look at those products has not kept pace. This will help us to sustain and strengthen our work around geographic adequacy and allow us to begin to understand the difference between geographic adequacy standards and timeliness standards by beginning to check not only do you have a provider in your network within the required number of miles, but how really available is that provider. So this would be kind of an important move forward in that direction. So this is a proposal of just under $500,000 in general fund with an additional $144,000 in fee revenues.
We have a question. We have a couple of questions. Is this a good moment? Okay, Representative Greenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the network adequacy and reviews, so you know, we had testimony, I believe it was last session, and we had testimony from patients that they had to wait over 60 days to get a doctor's appointment. I believe it was Northwest Minnesota. And they had to drive over an hour, hour and a half, and they had a doctor in their own hometown that they couldn't see because it wasn't in the network. So are you looking at the delay? You know, I just called, I haven't had a physical for a while, so I was trying to set the physical up. And it was, which isn't a medical necessity, I understand. But I just never have been put off for so many months to just schedule a physical as I have just recently, okay? And my wife also experienced a very similar thing in our local hospital. So do you look at the time delay also as far as these networks and the amount of time patients have to wait to actually see a medical provider?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly what we're proposing to enhance here, is that to be able to actually look below just the kind of the mileage standards. Do you have a provider within the X number of miles, but the timeliness of actual appointment availability is not something we've been able to rigorously examine previously.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So if you found this type of discrepancy where a person was actually had a health problem, was waiting 60 days, I mean, you could die by the time you get to see the doctor. What remedies are you going to propose? Do you know at this time, or are you going to work with the provide the insurance providers and the networks to try to expand that in that area, or how are you trying to address? Because we're facing a doctor shortage in the rural area, a critical doctor shortage.
Commissioner,
Madam Chair and Representative, you're right. This is actually kind of a layered problem, and part of the issue is lack of provider availability. But we could do a better job of understanding and more about the network decisions that health plans are making as to what's in the network, and assuring ourselves that not only is it a matter of theoretical geographic access, but that the providers are actually we should be monitoring what is the average time to get an appointment. We don't have the regulatory tools today to do anything about that other than approving or disapproving a network on the front end. But as we monitor the performance of that network, that might suggest to us that we need to come back and propose, you know, some additional policy initiatives to the legislature.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment.
Representative Brennan.
You know, there are several bills, including mine, that I chief authored, any willing provider bills, that are introduced at the legislature. So if you want to take a look at those and see if you could support one or more of them, I think it would open up some opportunities for people to see medical providers with a shorter wait time. That final comment. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And you might want to be a co-author on the bill that I'm putting together as well, because this is a big topic, and I bet you every single member around this table wants to do something about it.
We're getting closer all the time.
We are, and you know, when we get really close, we'll be able to get something done. So,
amen.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, we actually had a hearing just on the network adequacy measures and how they're interpreted, and learned that while it isn't state law, that is a time and distance measure, that your agency is not looking at the distance at all. In fact, it's assuming that you'll go a mile a minute, and that 30 miles is equal to 30 minutes. And I gave the example of someone who lives less than 5 miles from the largest outpatient center in downtown Minneapolis, where we had the best transit service. They would have to transfer. They would probably have to walk up to a half a mile, and they would have to leave an hour before their appointment. It would take them another hour to get home. So it would take 2 hours to get to a provider within 5 miles of their home. And so as we look at network adequacy, I will hope you will look at what's in the current law. And there are a variety of solutions to that, including requiring health plans to provide rides. Right now, they do it to a limited degree under certain programs, certain insurance products. Most of the time, they tell people just take the bus without understanding what that means. And bus is not cheap for someone who has to drag their kids along. I hope that you'll look at both standards in law, because your narrative on the change page doesn't reference that at all.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think you could continue, Commissioner. We have about 15 minutes left.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Loeffler. I'll definitely follow up with staff on those observations. The next proposal is for a $450,000 additional appropriation out of the Healthcare Access Fund to support the biennial Minnesota Health Access Survey, which we do between the Minnesota Department of Health and the University of Minnesota. This is really our most comprehensive, really the definitive study on what's going on with insurance, not only rates of coverage, but changes in the nature of coverage, who's gaining and losing coverage and why, what are the characteristics of the remaining uninsured, and what might be some paths to fill some of those coverage gaps. So it's been a really useful resource for policymakers as we seek to continue to close gaps in the insurance market. It also, this data also helps us, is a piece of the puzzle of looking at how the burden of healthcare costs is changing and what is happening to our last discussion on the unevenness of access to actual care as well as coverage. So what this funding will do is as time has gone along, the survey is becoming more and more expensive to conduct, partly as
the population is harder to reach in some respects. So this added funding will allow the continued rigor of the study as we have come to rely on it. With the survey is just simply more expensive than we've had the funding to do now. So if we need to cut back the survey to the level of the available funding, we'll be losing some of the analytic power in the survey, decreasing the number of questions asked so that we'd have a less comprehensive source of information. So we consider this to be a maintenance of effort to protect an important source of information. Okay. The next proposal is actually an offer of a repeal and a saver of money. This would produce a $321,000 savings in the SGSR account by repealing an unnecessary infection control law, which was first enacted in 1992. And since that time, not only have there been a lot of scientific advances in care and treatment for bloodborne infections, but within the healthcare provider system, standard precautions have now become the standard of practice, and the systems themselves are doing a good job of monitoring and managing and preventing infection transmission in healthcare settings. In fact, we have not had a documented case of transmission of HIV, Hep B, or C in a Minnesota healthcare setting since 1992. So we think that the healthcare boards, the health-related boards, can take regulatory actions if they are necessary, and that the systems are doing a good job with this. So we believe that the MDH efforts are unnecessarily redundant to the health regulatory board. So we offer to suspend this program. Okay. We're down to the last two here. This next is a request for additional appropriation out of the state government special revenue fund for the Office of Medical Cannabis. This, again, is not this is not proposing increasing fees. These are fees that are already being collected but are not appropriated to the department. When authorized in law in 2014, the medical cannabis program, the law capped the appropriations to MDH at a certain level based on our best fiscal estimates at that time. But since then, the program has more than doubled what we had projected the enrollment would be by now. So the program is much larger, both in terms of patients being served and providers who are prescribers in the system. And the current funding just has not kept pace with that growth. So we're unable to meet the quite realistic expectations for service that the fee payers have. They're paying plenty, as they will tell you, for this program, and but the fee revenue has not followed the growth of the program. And this also would, I think, not only help us keep pace with demand for services, but it also allows us to be doing a better job of making sure that the manufacturers are doing what they need to do to assure product safety and product supply. So it would strengthen our oversight of the program as well as just sort of the consumer service. As well, I think one of the good things about this program is the information that we are collecting on patient experience and provider experience, so that we can kind of add to the available knowledge on the effectiveness of medical cannabis for certain conditions. So for all those reasons, we think that this increase in appropriation of current fees is highly appropriate.
Surprised there are no questions about that, but we can go ahead, and we can always ask more at the end if there's more time.
So. Right. And the final budget proposal is for an operating adjustment for the agency. As you very well know, basic operating costs continue to increase, and without without inflation in the expense side of the budget ledger, we need to come and ask for specific appropriations to fund things like employee compensation increases that have already been agreed to, employer-paid health insurance, higher cost of technology services, and the higher costs of leases maintained by the Department of Administration. So for MDH, that needed operating adjustment for those cost drivers is spread across the general fund, the special revenue fund, and the access fund as a kind of just an allocation method across our non-federal funding sources. So that is, as you see there, a little over $3 million in general fund, 2.3 in SGSR, and $500,000 from the Access Fund. That completes the overview of the budget.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. And I guess I have one question on that very last piece that you mentioned. And you don't have to really answer right now, but I'm just kind of interested in how you make the decision about how to allocate the costs across those funds. And really, you don't have to answer that now, but it would be helpful to get some explanation of that as we move forward here. So we do have a few more minutes. Members, are there any questions on the presentation? Representative Ryan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to do some just quick, not really questions, but just that I'm really excited to see the governor investing in prevention. And as we look at the opioids, that he has a prevention plan there, looking at the comprehensive suicide that is focused around prevention, and also looking to the Community Solution Fund, which is really looking to the wisdom of community to know what really works best in partnership with the state about how to move forward in looking at eliminating the disparities that we are tackling our state, that is just really bringing down how others see us as a state when it comes to community of color. And I just also wanted to just highlight the tobacco cessation pieces too, that I think is really, really good that we are focusing on tobacco and how we can recognize that, there are, I think you said 580,000 individuals who are still smoking, and the impact that has on preventable health outcomes. So he's doing a really, I believe, in my opinion, he is doing a lot of good work to, at the end of the day, to help save the state money. But also to just really look at how we can do things differently and invest in the Department of Health and invest in improving how we work as a state, because, we can pass many bills, but if we don't fund them, or if we don't, move uphill, if we don't do things differently, at the end of the day, what we find ourselves doing is spending a whole lot of money with not a lot of great outcomes and not really big impact. So I just wanted to share that with this committee, but also uplift this administration.
All right. Thank you, Chair Moran. And I don't see any other questions. So thank you very much, Commissioner. And thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And we appreciate your presentation. It's been very interesting. And members, tomorrow we will be hearing from the Department of Human Services. So we are adjourned.
Thank you for your time. Thanks very much.